Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, we have a man who has been acquitting himself with great distinction, both in uniform as a combat surgeon, decorated combat surgeon at that, in Iraq, and now as a member of the House of Representatives representing the people of the 2nd Congressional District of Ohio. He is Congressman Brad Wenstrup, and it is a pleasure to have him back. He serves on the Armed Services Committee and the Intelligence Committee, two vantage points from which to consider and have responsibility for overseeing some of the really important issues we wanted to talk to him about. Congressman Wenstrup, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
I guess I'd like to start with your thoughts on the deal that the president is trying desperately to cut with the Iranians concerning their nuclear weapons program, particularly from the perspective of your Intelligence Committee responsibilities. I wonder what you make of the prospects for this thing being the verifiable, the difficulties with the International Atomic Energy Agency, even monitoring what's going on now, let alone what will happen under this deal.
Well, I would say that certainly the things that the Iranians have asked for in this, or the limitations that they have put on access, make it extremely unpalatable. Nonetheless, just the whole notion of trying to deal with a country that since 1979 has been chanting death to America and continues to chant death to America. And it appears that it's almost a deal at any cost. And I think that that's bad for America. And, you know, we are seeing currently an Iran that is working against the United States and has for many years. I served in Iraq. They were responsible for the deaths of many American soldiers. And continue to fight against this, and it just seems like a bad deal to me all the way around.
Yeah. I imagine during your tour there as a combat surgeon, you had to try to cope with the consequences of some of their improvised explosive devices, the advanced ones that they were providing to the insurgents who cost us dearly in terms of lives lost and soldiers maimed.
Yeah, you know, as a surgeon, you never forget those that you couldn't save. And you don't forget those that are carrying scars of what they have done. They'll carry those scars the rest of their life. So it's pretty hard to sit and accept and think that this is a changed people in some way.
Yeah. You know, Congressman Wenstrup, one of the other things that was worrying to me is that the administration seems to be going to such lengths to sell this deal that they're actually cooking the books on some of the terrorism that is ongoing, apparently downplaying some of the ballistic missile developments that the Iranians are engaged in. These are the sorts of things that will only become vastly more problematic if we wind up giving the Iranians more money, sanctions relief, or a signing bonus. What's your take overall on the advisability of this deal?
Well, you lose the sanctions, and it will only fuel or fund the worldwide anti-U.S. aggression that's coming out of Iran. This is precisely playing into their hands, in my opinion. And I think it's the last thing that we need to do. We saw that the sanctions were effective. Look, they at least want to talk for the first time in decades, and that's because the sanctions are working, and I think we need to continue those. And also, the other concern that we have is the congressional role, and that's very unclear as to what this is going to look like and what Congress's role in this is going to be as far as allowance or not allowance.
Well, we hope it will be active and decisive in opposing this deal, and your leadership in that regard is really needed. Congressman, let me ask you about a related topic. There's a report in today that there are now U.S. special forces based at a facility in Takutum in Iraq. with Shiite militias backed by the Iranians. From an intelligence perspective, to say nothing of an operational security perspective and the personnel security perspective, is this advisable in your judgment?
Well, it certainly isn't a situation I'd want to find myself in as a soldier, to be mixed with that particular entity. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, and it seems very dangerous for those involved. Now, I have no doubt that our special operators have tremendous talent. However, in this particular situation, it seems like it puts them in greater risk than they would in any other area of Iraq.
Yeah. And again, just another example of kind of how we're treating the Iranians that is likely to redound to our detriment. Let me switch gears, if I may. Again, our guest is Congressman Brad Winstrup, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, as well as the House Armed Services Committee. And I know you're following, Congressman, developments in the Western Pacific, notably the introduction of these man-made islands by the Chinese, and also their attacks, their hacking into our databases at the Office of Personnel Management, your file, my file, a lot of us presumably compromised. We are watching the administration have a so-called strategic and economic dialogue with the Chinese, which seems to be treating these very serious problems as kind of minor difficulties to be managed in the spirit of moving this relationship along. How do you see this relationship at the moment?
Well, I think they're trying to flex their muscles to any degree that they possibly can. You've seen cyber attacks, and I think that that's about building as much information as they possibly can. When you talk about South China Sea and areas like that, they're trying to exert their influence on the region. And, you know, it's like the kid that'll push the teacher as far as they possibly can, you know, and then does it finally reach an end? I don't think that they are concerned necessarily about any pushback from the United States of significance. And that's a problem for us, and that's a problem for our friends in the region as well. And they're concerned, where we are in this arena.
Yeah, and I must say I'm concerned about where we are as well. This is unfortunately a situation that you probably have as good an appreciation as anybody for. Talk a little, if you would, about what the kind of data that the Chinese have obtained from files of U.S. government personnel that might be available to them and used by them for espionage or for related kinds of subversive activities in our country.
Well, they certainly are getting a huge database, and from what I understand, that it's up to about 18 million just from OPM, which is a tremendous amount of Americans that are vulnerable then, can be solicited in certain ways. They're always trying to reach out for recruitment. These are the problems that we face, and the House has passed legislation last spring addressing our cybersecurity issues, and we need the Senate to take it up. Essentially, we're at World War III when it comes to the cyber world today, and we need to be out ahead of things rather than trying to catch up.
Let me turn to one other area where we may be lagging, and that is as a result of apparently the number of carriers, aircraft carriers, contracting. We are going to face a situation in which we will not have an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf for some months. The rotations now being staggered in such a way that there will be a gap. Having served in that theater, Congressman, what is your sense of both that as a tactical problem, but also what it suggests is more generally the difficulty we're facing with the readiness and maintaining the numbers of forces that we need?
Well, no carrier in the Gulf is certainly doesn't bode well for us and just where we are when it comes to defense in general. You know, we passed a bill in the House. President Obama is threatening to veto a troop funding bill. Some Democrats right now are filibustering it, and they want to hold out more money for the IRS and EPA. But also, you know, I think we'd be willing to end the sequester on the Department of Defense. The president said he would veto that unless he got that for everything. So this is a very serious time as we're drawing down and the rest of the world is taking notice to us drawing down, and it leaves us more and more vulnerable. It's no secret And it's a shame. I believe in peace through strength. And when we have been a great deterrent, we've had great success. Let's just look at the Cold War.
Well, we very strongly endorse that sentiment. Peace through strength is kind of our motto around here, and we appreciate you practicing it in the United States Congress. Again, Congressman Brad Wenstrup, medical doctor, lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves, your service in uniform as well as in the House of Representatives is really deeply appreciated, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, sir. Keep it up, and be
okay,
well.
Okay, thank you. It's my honor. Thank you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country. The one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity. A law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by the mayor of Irving, Texas. Her name is Beth Van Dyne. Last night, I was privileged to present her with the Center for Security Policy's Defender of Freedom Award for her really quite valiant efforts to understand and address in a thoughtful and appropriate way an effort made earlier by some of her constituents to establish the first Islamic tribunal in the United States with the explicit purpose of trying to have this become kind of a model for what would be done elsewhere as well. Mayor Van Dyne, thank you very much for joining us. It's good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You did a marvelous job last night. I think one of the things that impressed everybody in the audience was kind of how this whole thing came about. Remind us of the circumstances, if you would.
Back in January, there was a press release that was sent out by the Islamic Tribunal. They were talking about how they were going to set up the first Islamic Tribunal in the U.S. There was a local news report by CBS London News where they were interviewed in front of a mosque in Irving, and they just talked about what they were setting up. A lot of people got confused and thought that the city of Irving, you know how that happens, the city of Irving was creating a separate court. They created a website that really went into detail about the type of laws that they were practicing, what they were enforcing. They referred to their imams as attorneys. They referred to their imams as judges. Under practice areas of law, they had product liability, business and real estate litigation, divorce, child custody cases. And it was things that if a layperson would have assumed it was a law firm. A layperson would have assumed, since they considered it courts and they talked about judges, that it was a separate area of law that was being enforced and practiced in the U.S.
We're visiting with Mayor Beth Van Dyne, the mayor of the city of Irving, Texas, near Dallas, and a hotbed, it turns out, of efforts to inculcate inside her city, a program that is quite at odds with our Constitution. Its adherents call it Sharia. And Mayor Van Dyne, when you took a look at this website and what it was representing it would try to do, how did you respond?
Part of the issues, it's not only just against the U.S. Constitution, but, you know, quite literally, it's against the state statutes of the state of Texas. It's, you know, the unauthorized practice of law. You don't hold yourself out as being an attorney when you're not, when you're a JD. You don't hold yourself out as representing individuals in courts that don't exist. So how I ended up putting out a statement on my Facebook page that said that I was going to get to the bottom of that. I was going to find out more information. This caused a lot of people to get really upset. We had a meeting, and during that meeting, a number of members of the mosque from my city came, and they wanted me to issue a retraction for my Facebook posting. They wanted me to clarify what their tribunal was. And it's important to note that from the time that this began in January to now, their website that advertises has changed number of times.
Covering their tracks.
You know, they no longer call themselves attorneys. They no longer call themselves judges. There's a disclaimer on it now. They put a constitution of what their points are. It's been really interesting. I don't think any of that would have happened had you not had a little bit of questioning of it, if it wasn't coming out publicly that these things were happening. If we had just chosen to ignore it, it would not have changed.
A little bit of questioning is an interesting way to put it. I mean, you really wound up getting into quite a very earnest conversation with the proponents of this, both those most immediately involved and quite a number of their supporters. Talk about, if you would, both the meeting in your own office and then the city council meeting where this thing played out rather dramatically.
Well, we had three of our state reps who were actually fantastic in helping create and helping support legislation as the American Laws for American Courts bill in the state legislature in Texas. What we were hoping to be able to do is actually get the support of this group. The bill simply talked about not holding higher foreign law than domestic law in cases where doing so would violate fundamental human rights and state statutes of both Texas and the U.S. Constitution. This really should have been a no-brainer. Anybody who lives in this country, everybody should want to follow the laws, obey the laws, and respect the laws. And having a group, you know, suggest that they were creating a court that was not doing that, and giving them an opportunity to support a bill that said they would, you know, respect our laws. Instead of them coming out in support of this, we had 300 members of that mosque come down to our city council meeting and oppose it. We were called, you know, the 5 members of that city council that supported this, the bill, the American laws, we were called racists, we were hateful, we were called bigots. It was ridiculous, all because we chose to support not violating fundamental human rights.
And it does seem as though there's no getting around it, that what these folks had in mind in terms of promoting an alternative program that is clearly hostile to constitutional rights, particularly for women and children, would be something very much at odds with what you had sworn an oath to uphold and defend, as did the other members of your city council who had to vote on this matter. And yet 4 of them voted in favor of this Sharia tribunal being established.
What we were told was this was a hateful act, that this was a divisive act, and that by the city council doing it, one, we had no business to even bring this forward on our council agenda. And 2, that even if they agreed with it in spirit, they were going to vote against it because they did not want to offend members of the mosque. That was their defense for it.
This is a sort of recurring theme now. And, of course, you saw it in a nearby community, Garland, Texas, where we were subsequent to all of this told that it was impermissible to give offense to Muslims by drawing cartoon of the prophet. Are you sensing, Mayor Beth Van Dyne of Irving, Texas, that there is now a growing, determination on the part of some within the Muslim community, not all of them, but some within the Muslim community to sort of impose this program, Sharia blasphemy restrictions on the one hand and this sort of court on, at the minimum, people of the Muslim faith?
I think, one, that you have elected officials who don't respect what we have in our own country, in our community, in our state, and we're not willing to speak out in support of that. You're seeing the destruction of our culture, and that bothers me. When I see members of my community who claim to represent women, there was a president of our Democratic Club that came down. When I see these people coming down and they are supportive of a court that discriminates against women, women's rights under Sharia law are trampled upon. A woman has half of the strength of a man's testimony. A woman cannot get a divorce. A woman has to ask permission from an imam to get a divorce.
Whereas a man can simply say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and it's done. Mayor, we have got to leave it at that for the moment. We are so pleased that you were kind enough to accept this recognition from us, the Defender of Freedom Award. You've certainly deserved it, and we hope that you will continue to hold up the Constitution of the United States you've sworn to defend and serve as an example for the rest of us as well. Keep up the good work. Come back to us again very soon. Andy McCarthy joins us next. We'll talk about some very dubious rulings in our court system. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Hundreds of Chinese officials are in Washington for something called the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. It appears to be a dialogue of the deaf. An unnamed State Department official is quoted as saying the talks are an exercise in narrowing the differences between the two sides. The truth is that what we have are not differences to be managed and narrowed. Rather, we now confront an increasingly overtly hostile China, seeking to displace and, if necessary, to defeat the United States in the Pacific and likely beyond. Chinese hacking of our computers and island building in the South China Sea are acts that require appropriate responses now. Engaging in dialogue that purports simply to manage them is a formula for far more serious acts of aggression and possibly war in the future. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. At the G7 summit in Germany this week, President Obama said this about his strategy to take on ISIS in Iraq.
When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. We don't yet have a complete strategy.
How can President Obama in June 2015 still not have a plan to deal with ISIS in Iraq? After all, he also said this in August 2014. The truth is the president does have a strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's to put significant restrictions on U.S. troops and to do as little as possible so he can say he's a president who got the United States out of wars, not into one. Ultimately, the president wants to hand this mess to the next president. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's the high point of my week, I'm fond of saying. It's our visit with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor turned pundit extraordinaire and columnist for National Review Online and PJ Media, the author of numerous best-selling books, including a personal favorite of mine, Willful Blindness, of which there seems to be an abundance at the moment. Andy, as always, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Frank, thanks so much for having me.
Well, there is a lot going on, Andy, and nobody parses better than you, particularly what's going on in the area where there's this kind of a nexus between national security and the law. And I guess I'd like to start by reviewing with you two recent court decisions, one an appellate court ruling, the other the Supreme Court ruling. Let's start with the first, the appellate court going after military commissions. These things have been controversial practically from the get-go. What do you make of what the court's done, and what are its implications?
Well, Frank, I think the bottom line is it may be the last nail in the coffin of military commissions. I think that that's a bad thing in prospect. It may not be a bad thing concretely in this sense. The military commissions, as they've been carried out, frankly, they haven't done a good job. And those of us who supported them, and I supported them very strongly because I still think they're an important part of a successful counterterrorism strategy, have to be disappointed in the way that the few cases that we've had have been adjudicated. That said, I think the appellate court's decision was really an outrageous one. Basically, they threw out a case against a very high-ranking al-Qaeda official who had actually been sort of the al-Qaeda's answer to Goebbels, including not only being the propagandist, but also a key aide personally to Osama bin Laden at the time of the 9/11 attacks. They had already thrown out half the case on him on what I thought were a very difficult to understand ex post facto grounds. And now in the new case, what they basically said is that conspiracy is not properly triable by military commission, even though Congress and the president came together at the behest of the Supreme Court, I would add, to formulate a military commission system and make conspiracy an offense. So I think for a court to come in after the branches of the government that are charged constitutionally with responsibility for the conduct of warfare and for national security, for a court to come in like this and upset that balance is really an exercise or an exhibition of arrogance. I'd like to see the case get reviewed, but I don't know if it actually will.
It seems second only to the president simply sending all these guys from Gitmo home, including a number that are, as you've indicated, it was the case with this fellow al-Bahul, had actually, you know, close ties with Osama bin Laden himself. It's deeply, deeply troubling. Andy, let me turn to another court ruling. The Supreme Court had a decision in a case involving license plates, and you're reading a fair amount into it. Talk about what you think they've done and again, its implications.
Well, I think it's a very dangerous case for free expression, right? You know, in the abstract, the case sounds like it's harmless enough. The state of Texas basically forbade the issuance of these vanity specialty license plates that one proposal to have such a plate was to have it emblazoned with the Confederate battle flag. And I think if that was all it was about, it'd be perfectly reasonable for a state to say, you know, we don't want to issue state material that has the Confederate flag on it. I don't want to wade into the merits of the debates because there's, you know, passionate feelings on both sides of that. I just think it's reasonable for a state to say, you know, we don't want to do this. But if you took a step back and looked at this, it turns out that the state of Texas has approved some 350 different vanity plates or specialty plates, some of which are obviously not the speech of the state. You know, things like Go Oklahoma State University, which of course is one of the arch rivals of the Texas schools in sports. So clearly, vanity plates are better understood as the statements of the people who drive the cars rather than the statements of the state that issues it, which means that gets us into the state discriminating among the viewpoints of speakers. And I think it's a very dangerous doctrine if you can say that if the state in any way has underwritten or regulated the medium in which the speech is communicated, it can then regulate the content of speech so that it can allow the speech it approves of and repress the speech that it suppress the speech that it disapproves of. And I think that's the real nub of it. That's the danger of what happened in this case.
Andy, is the logic of what you're saying that we really should simply eliminate all of these vanity plates and just have good old-fashioned state-issued licenses for the purposes of just identifying the dang car?
Oh, yeah. I think, Frank, that if the state is going to allow specialty plates, you know, short of traditional exemptions to free speech like obscenity, they have to let all viewpoints be reflected. And if they don't want to go down that road, which I think is perfectly understandable, they should not allow any speech at all. That way they're not discriminating one way or the other.
As I understand it, one of the dissenters, and I don't remember who it was, it sounds like Scalia, said it's the dang bumper sticker that you want to use to express all these things.
Yeah, Justice Alito, but joined by Scalia and the Chief Justice, and I think absolutely right about that.
Andy, let me turn quickly to another topic. You have been engaged in this controversy about the Trade Promotion Authority. As we speak, the Senate is about to cast perhaps the final vote on approving it, at least the procedural steps that will assure that it is approved. Senator Ted Cruz has reversed his position on it. You've just written about it in The Corner at National Review Online. Give us a quick sense of this. It's obviously a moving train as this program is being recorded, but where do you think this is likely to leave us?
Well, wherever it leaves us, Frank, I think what Senator Cruz is saying is that Trade Promotion Authority looks like it's being used as a smokescreen, potentially, to ram through some bad legislation like immigration reform, or what's called immigration reform, and the Export-Import Bank, which is an exquisite exhibit in crony capitalism. I've argued that I think trade is good for the country. Trade Promotion and Authority is important to trade, and it's certainly constitutional, but it has to be weighed like everything else. And I must say, if I were convinced, and Cruz is a lot closer to it than I am, but if I were convinced, as he's become convinced, that this was just a scheme to get bad bills that can't pass with a regular legislative process through, then I wouldn't support it either. So I think he's quite right to change his position if that's what he's convinced is happening.
Well, and I welcome this because I became convinced of this a long time ago, that what we're witnessing here in terms of these kinds of trade deals, specifically this Trans-Pacific Partnership, has become mutated beyond recognition with all manner of things, including, according to Senator Jeff Sessions, who's probably done the most yeoman work in exposing to the light of day what's actually going on here in this rather secretive process, arrangements to create sort of a European Union equivalent to adjudicate or actually promulgate not just regulations but what amount to laws in the future, quite contrary to our Constitution.
Yeah, my fear continues to be that if Congress can tweak these bills, we're more likely to get the passage of a bad bill than an up or down vote, which I think it's easier to beat a bad bill on an up or down vote. But that's just, I mean, that's my strategic analysis of it. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, we will be watching closely to see what the Senate does. Andy, as always, we're benefiting from your close watching of what the Congress and so much else is afoot. Keep up the good work, my friend, at National Review Online and at PJ Media and, of course, Fox, and as well as here. We look forward to our visits so much. Thank you again for your time. Next up, Peter Pham joins us. We'll take stock of what's happening in Africa and what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. J. Peter Pham, one of our duty experts on Africa. He holds a position as director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, the author of numerous books, including one he co-authored with Greg Mills and David Kilcullen entitled Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Welcome back, Peter. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Let's talk about Boko Haram first, Peter. This is, of course, an Al-Qaeda franchise that has now sworn its loyalty to the Islamic State, declared itself to be part of a caliphate. You have been raising concerns about the increasing sophistication of its military operations against the Nigerian military.
What's going on there, and what are the implications?
Well, a couple of things, Frank. First, beginning probably in end of January, Nigeria and its neighbors began pushing back on Boko Haram. Remember, back in January, Boko Haram had managed to seize territory, probably depending on which analysts you speak to, either the size of Maryland or something larger, and had occupied it and set up their little emirate, if you will, with a headquarters in Gwoza, a town of about 150,000 people, so not insignificant. But then the military forces began rolling back the territory and taking back territory, at which point Boko Haram, which had had ties to Al-Qaeda, hadn't formally become an affiliate, turned and swore its allegiance to the Islamic State. Now, we've talked in the past about how last year the two groups, the so-called Islamic State and Boko Haram, had been romancing each other and doing shout-outs and perhaps a little bit of backroom support in terms of technical capabilities of videos and things like that. And they swore allegiance, and within very short order, that allegiance was accepted. At that time, a lot of analysts thought this is a group that's on its in desperate straits because of the military push against it, so it needs a fill-up. And at that time, the Islamic State was also getting pushback, so it needed sort of a morale boost, and the allegiance provided it. Since then, Boko Haram has metastasized. This is a group with a great deal of resilience. It's increased its terrorist attacks. In fact, this past week launched its first attack against Chad's capital, N'Djamena, attack on two police facilities, which left over 24 people killed, two attacks. Just in recent days, it's launched attacks against targets in Niger. So it's carrying out terrorist attacks in neighboring countries. And in fact, just today, launched attacks on a market in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, Nigeria. But it's not just the terrorist attacks, but it's also been the military tactics. Something happened after the rebranding of Boko Haram as the Islamic State's West Africa province, as it's calling itself nowadays. And that's been the sophistication of its attacks on military forces. It's no longer just hit and run or attacks followed by the military fleeing, but relatively sophisticated ambushes and other things. So clearly there's a qualitative shift, and that's very dangerous.
And Peter Pham, before we switch gears to Sudan, just in closing, do you regard what's developing on the ground, not just now in Nigeria, but in Chad and Niger, as evidence that Boko Haram is becoming, unfortunately, a still more formidable threat to the region and perhaps beyond?
Well, I'm not sure I'm ready to say more formidable, but I'm certainly going to say that it remains a major threat to the region, and reports of its demise that were trumpeted by not only some in the Nigerian government, especially the outgoing administration, but also by people on this side of the Atlantic who tried to downplay the group's significance. Those reports are, as Mark Twain once said, rather exaggerated.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He's also a member of the Senior Advisory Group of U.S. Africa Command and has been since its inception. Peter, let me, as I say, ask you to turn your gaze to another part of the African continent, Sudan. Now, two countries. It's been broken into. The original piece of Sudan, the north, largely under the brutally repressive Islamists' control. The southern part, now a separate nation, but riven by civil war. Maybe we could start with the latter. What is the latest on developments there, Peter, and a real humanitarian crisis that seems to be developing as a result of the war?
A couple things are going on. Right now, South Sudan is in the middle of the rainy season. And so that limits the ability to carry out major military operations because what few roads there are in the country are largely not paved, and the rainy season turns most of the country into a literal bog. And so as a result of that, military actions have been relatively limited, and there have been on and off, in fact, this week on again, discussions of peace. But this is a lull in the fighting dictated by the weather more than any real peace. And in the meantime, however, the rains, the impassibility of land has exacerbated the food security situation. Hundreds of thousands of people are cut off from food aid because they simply can't get through. In the meantime, farmers aren't planting those that aren't displaced. You know, several million people have already been displaced. But those who aren't displaced aren't planting because if you're insecure, uncertain about whether you're going to be around next week, much less when harvest time comes, you're not going to plant. You might as well take your seed and eat it. At least that way you nourish you and your family, which is setting the country up for a major food crisis when the harvest is due and nothing's been planted.
And this is all the more amazing, of course, because this is a country endowed with enormous petroleum resources, and to the prospect that it would starve to death is just beyond belief.
Most of the, unfortunately, the oil production has been cut by more than two-thirds, so the money isn't coming in. And that partially because of the fighting, partially because the engineers they need to run those things have fled, understandably.
Peter, a crisis of the first order. Let me turn to the country to its north, Sudan. You had a spectacle recently of the Islamist who has been running the place for years, General Bashir, in South Africa and wanted by the International Criminal Court but allowed to escape. Give us a sense of what happened in all of that.
President Bashir went to South Africa, which was hosting this year the annual meeting of the heads of state and government of the African Union. Now, the African Union, a while back, came out with a statement saying that its members shouldn't cooperate with the International Criminal Court because the International Criminal Court was biased against Africans. The South African government decided that it would honor the AU's declaration. So a NGO brought a lawsuit before a high court judge to compel the arrest of Bashir on this warrant. While the court was considering the motions and had ordered that the Sudanese leader not leave the country with the obvious collusion of the South African government, his plane, which was parked at a civilian commercial airport, was moved to a military airstrip, and then he got on board and flew back to Khartoum to a triumphal return. But the underlying issue is not so much the alleged war crimes perpetrated by Bashir in the Darfur conflict, but the fact that the International Criminal Court has been attempting to operate in a vacuum. You know, justice only works when there's political legitimacy for the process. And it's not saying that the ICC or the charges being brought against various African leaders aren't without foundation. But the ICC has not been very good at cultivating that political legitimacy. It's allowed cynical leaders to, as well as those who act in good faith, to say that the ICC has some sort of bias against Africans. They use that to justify their non-cooperation with it.
It is a deeply problematic institution, it seems to me, Peter, and you've just touched on some of the examples of why. We have to let it go at that, though, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.